The Complete Norse Mythology, adapted by Kevin Crossley Holland, music by Mats Wendt, read by Tom Harris. Part 1. The Creation. Burning ice, biting flame. That is how life began. In the south is a realm called Muspel. That region flickers with dancing flames. It seethes and it shines. No one can endure it except those born into it. Black Surt is there. He sits on the furthest reach of that land, brandishing a flaming sword. He is already waiting for the end, when he will rise and savage the gods and whelm the whole world with fire. In the north is a realm called Niflheim. It is packed with ice and covered in vast sweeps of snow. In the heart of that region lies the spring, Hvergelmir, and that is the source of 11 rivers named the Elvigar. They are Kul Svol and Gunnthra the Defiant, Fjorm and bubbling Fimbulthul, fearsome Slid and storming Hrid, Silg, Ilg, broad Vid, and Leipt, which streaks like lightning, and freezing Gjoll. Between these realms there once stretched a huge and seeming emptiness. This was Ginnungagap. The rivers that sprang from Hvergelmir streamed into the void. The yeasty venom in them thickened and congealed like slag, and the rivers turned into ice. That venom also spat out drizzle, an unending dismal haggar that as soon as it settled turned into rime. So it went on until all the northern part of Ginnungagap was heavy with layers of ice and hoarfrost, a desolate place haunted by gusts and scuthers of wind. Just as the northern part was frozen, the southern was molten and glowing, but the middle of Ginnungagap was as mild as hanging air in the summer evening. There the warm breath drifting north from Muspel met the rime from Niflheim. They touched it and played over it, and the ice began to thaw and drip. Life quickened in those drops, and they took the form of a giant. He was called Ymir. Ymir was a frost giant. He was evil from the first. While he slept, he began to sweat. A man and woman grew out of the ooze under his left armpit, and one of his legs fathered a son on the other leg. Ymir was the forefather of all the frost giants, and they named him Aurelgamir. As more of the ice in Ginnungagap melted, the fluid took the form of a cow. She was called Audumla. Ymir fed off the four rivers of milk that coursed from her teats, and Audumla fed off the ice itself. She licked the salty blocks, and by the evening of the first day a man's hair had come out of the ice. Audumla licked more, and by the evening of the second day, a man's head had come. Audumla licked again, and by the evening of the third day, the whole man had come. His name was Búri. Búri was tall and strong and good-looking. In time, he had a son called Bor, and Bor married a daughter of Bolthor, one of the frost giants. Her name was Bestla, and she mothered three children, all of them sons. The first was Odin, the second was Vili, and the third was Ve. All this was in the beginning, before there were waves of sand, the sea's cool waves, waving grass. There was no earth and no heaven above, only Muspel and Niflheim, and between them, Ginnungagap. The three sons of Bor had no liking for Ymir and the growing gang of unruly, brutal frost giants. As time went on, they grew to hate them. At last they attacked Ymir and killed him. His wounds were like springs. So much blood streamed from them and so fast that the flood drowned all the frost giants except Hvergelmir and his wife. They embarked in their boat. It was made out of a hollowed tree trunk and rowed on a tide of gore. Odin and Vili and Ve hoisted the body of the dead frost giants onto their shoulders and carted it to the middle of Ginnungagap. That is where they made the world from his body. They shaped the earth from Ymir's flesh and the mountains from his unbroken bones. From his teeth and jaws and the fragments of his shattered bones, they made rocks and boulders and stones. Odin and Vili and Ve used the welter of blood to make landlocked lakes and to make the sea. After they had formed the earth, they laid the rocking ocean in a ring right around it. And it is so wide that most men would dismiss the very idea of crossing it. Then the three brothers raised Ymir's skull and made the sky from it, and placed it so that its four corners reached to the ends of the earth. They set a dwarf under each corner, and their names are East and West and North and South. Then Odin and Vili and Ve seized upon the sparks and glowing embers from Muspel, and called them sun and moon and stars. They put them high in Ginnungagap to light heaven above and earth below. In this way, the brothers gave each star its proper place. Some were fixed in the sky, others were free to follow the paths appointed for them. The earth was round and lay within the ring of the deep sea. Along the strand, the sons of Bor marked out tracts of land and gave them to the frost giants and the rock giants, and there, in Jotunheim, the giants settled and remained. They were so hostile that the three brothers built an enclosure further inland around a vast area of the earth. They shaped it out of Ymir's eyebrows and called it Midgard. The sun warmed the stones in the earth there, and the ground was green with sprouting leeks. The sons of Bor used Ymir's brains as well. They flung them up into the air and turned them into every kind of cloud. One day Odin and Vili and Ve were striding across the frayed edge of the land, where the earth meets the sea. They came across two fallen trees with their roots ripped out of the ground. One was an ash, the other an elm. Then the sons of Bor raised them and made from them the first man and woman. Odin breathed into them the breath of life. Vili offered them sharp wits and feeling hearts. And Ve gave them the gifts of hearing and sight. The man was called Ask, and the woman Embla, and they were given Midgard to live in. All the families and nations and races of men are descended from them. One of the giants living in Jotunheim, Narvi, had a daughter called Night, who was as dark-eyed, dark-haired, and swarthy as the rest of her family. She married three times. Her first husband was a man called Naglfari, and their son was Aud. Her second husband was Anar, and their daughter was Earth. And her third husband was Shining Delling, who was related to the sons of Bor. Their son was Day, and like all his father's side of the family, Day was radiant and fair of face. Then Odin took Night and her son Day, sat them in horse-drawn chariots, and set them into the sky to ride around the world every 2 half-days. Night leads the way, and her horse is frosty-maned Hrimfaxi. Day's horse is Skinfaxi. He has a gleaming mane that lights up the sky and earth alike. A man called Mundulfari, living in Midgard, had two children, and they were so beautiful that he called his son Moon and his daughter Sun. Sun married a man named Glenn. Odin and his brothers and their offspring, the Aesir, were angered at such daring. They snatched away both the children and placed them in the sky to guide the chariots of the sun and moon, the constellations made by the sons of Bor to light the world out of the sparks of Muspel. Moon leads the way. He guides the moon on its path and decides when he will wax and wane. He does not travel alone, as you can see if you look into the sky, for Moon in turn plucked two children for Midgard, Bil and Hjuki, whose father is Vidfinn. They were just walking away from the well Birgir, carrying between them the water cask Sog on the pole Simul, when Moon swooped down and carried them off. Sun follows behind. One of her horses is called Arvak because he rises so early, and the other Alsvid because he is immensely strong. The Aesir inserted iron-cold bellows under their shoulder blades to keep them cool. Sun always seems to be in a great hurry, and that is because she is chased by Skoll, the wolf who is always snapping and growling close behind her. In the end, he will catch her. And the wolf that races in front of Sun is called Hati. He is after Moon and will run him down in the end. Both wolves are the sons of an aged giantess who lived in Ironwood, east of Midgard. After the sons of Bor had made the first man and woman, and set night and day, moon and sun in the sky, they remembered the maggots that had squirmed and swarmed in Ymir's flesh and crawled out over the earth. Then they gave them the wits and the shape of men, but they live under the hills and mountains and rocky chambers and grottos and caverns. These man-like maggots are called dwarfs. Modsognir is their leader, and his deputy is Durin. So the earth was fashioned and filled with men and giants and dwarfs, surrounded by the sea and covered by the sky. Then the sons of Bor built their own realm of Asgard, a mighty stronghold, a place of green plains and shining palaces high over Midgard. The two regions were linked by Bifrost, a flaming rainbow bridge. It was made of three colors, with magic and great skill, and it is wonderfully strong. All the Aesir, the guardians of men, crossed over and settled in Asgard. Odin, Allfather, is the oldest and greatest of them all. There are 12 divine gods and 12 divine goddesses and a great assembly of other Aesir. And this was the beginning of all that has happened, remembered or forgotten in the regions of the world. And all that has happened and all the regions of the world lie under the branches of the ash, Yggdrasil, greatest and best of trees. It swears over all that is. Its three roots delve into Asgard and Jotunheim and Niflheim, and there is a spring under each. A hawk and eagle sit in it. A squirrel scurries up and down it. Deer leap within it and nibble at it. A dragon devours it, and it is sprinkled with dew. It gives life to itself. It gives life to the unborn. The winds whirl round it, and Yggdrasil croons or groans. Yggdrasil always was, and is, and will be. The War of the Aesir and the Vanir. Odin did not extend a friendly welcome to the witch Gullveig when she came to visit him. In his hall, the High One and many of the other Aesir listened with loathing as she talked of nothing but her love of gold, her lust for gold. They thought that the worlds would be better off without her, and angrily seized and tortured her. They riddled her body with spears. Then the Aesir hurled Gullveig onto the fire in the middle of the hall. She was burned to death, but out of the flames she stepped whole and reborn. Three times the Aesir burned Gullveig's body, and three times she lived again. Then wherever she went, and she went everywhere, into every hall, Gullveig was given another name. The awed Aesir and their servants called her Hyde, the Gleaming One. She was a seer. She enchanted wands of wood. She went into trances and cast spells. She was mistress of evil magic, the delight of every evil woman. When the Vanir heard how the Aesir had welcomed Gullveig, they were incensed as the Aesir had been by Gullveig's gold lust. They swore vengeance and began to prepare for war. But there was nothing that escaped Odin when he sat on his high seat in Valaskjalf. The Aesir, too, sharpened their spears and polished their shields. Very soon the gods moved against each other, and Odin cast his spear into the host of the Vanir. That was the beginning of the first war in the world. At first the Vanir gained ground. They used spells and reduced the towering walls of Asgard to rubble. But the Aesir fought back and surged forward and caused no less damage in Vanaheim, the world of the Vanir. For a long time the battle raged to and fro, and the longer it lasted, the clearer it became that neither side was likely to win. Then the gods on both sides grew weary of war. Talk and truce seemed better than such turmoil. So the leaders of the Aesir and the Vanir met to discuss terms. They argued about the war's origins, and whether the Aesir alone were guilty of causing the war, or whether both sides were entitled to tribute. The end of the discussion was that the Aesir and the Vanir swore to live side by side in peace, and agreed to exchange leaders as proof of their intentions. So, two leading Vanir, Njord and his son Freyr, made their way to Asgard. Njord's daughter Freyja journeyed with them, and so did Kvasir, wisest of the Vanir. The Aesir welcomed and accepted them, much as they disliked the fact that Frey and Freyja were the children of Njord by his own sister. They appointed Njord and Freyr's high priests to preside over sacrifices, and Freyja was consecrated a sacrificial priestess. She soon taught the Aesir all the witchcraft that was well known and in common use in Vanaheim. For their part, the Aesir sent long-legged Hœnir and wise Mimir to live in Vanaheim. Hœnir was well-built and handsome, a figure of substance. The Aesir thought he would make an enviable leader in war and peace alike. Mimir, like Kvasir, was held to be second to none in his understanding and wisdom. The Vanir welcomed and accepted them. They at once appointed Hœnir to be one of their leaders, and Mimir stood at his right hand, always ready with shrewd advice. Together they were unfailing. When Hœnir was separated from Mimir, though, things were rather different. Standing alone in a council or meeting and asked for his opinion, Hœnir's reply was always the same. Well, let the others decide. The Vanir began to suspect that the Aesir had tricked them, and that they had got very much the worse in exchange of leaders. And soon their suspicion turned to outright anger and thoughts of revenge. They seized wise Mimir and threw him to the ground and hacked off his head. They told one of their messengers to take it back to those who had so thoughtfully sent it, Odin and the Aesir. Odin took Mimir's head and cradled it. He smeared it with herbs to preserve it, so that it would never decay. And then the High One sang charms over it, and gave back to Mimir's head the power of speech. So its wisdom became Odin's wisdom, many truths unknown to any other being. The Building of Asgard's Wall. Long after the Golden Age, it was still very early in the cycle of time. And long after the war between the Aesir and the Vanir, the wall around Asgard that the Vanir had raised with their battle magic remained a ring of rubble, deserted, the home of eagles and ravens. The gods were anxious that the wall should be rebuilt so that Asgard would be safe from evildoers, but none were eager to take the heavy burden of rebuilding on their own shoulders. This is how matters stood for some time, until one day, a solitary figure on horseback cantered over the trembling rainbow and was stopped by the watchman Heimdall. "I've got a plan to put to the gods," said the man. "You can tell it to me," said Heimdall warmly. He had felt curious as he had watched this man approach from 100 miles off, and smiled, showing his gold teeth. "I'll tell all the gods if I tell it all," said the man from his saddle. "The goddesses may also be interested." Heimdall showed his teeth again in a less friendly manner, and directed the man across the plain of Ida to Gladsheim. So the gods and goddesses gathered in Gladsheim. Their visitor tied up his stallion and stepped forward under the shining roof to the middle of the hall. He was surrounded by Odin and the 12 leading gods, each sitting in his high place, and by a throng of gods and goddesses. Odin eyed him piercingly. "We are all here at Heimdall's bidding. What do you have to say?"
"Only this," said the man. "I'll rebuild your wall around Asgard."
There was a stir in Gladsheim as the gods and goddesses realized that there must be rather more to the builder than met the eye.
"The wall will be much stronger and higher than before," said the builder. "So strong and high that it will be impregnable. Asgard will be secure against the rock giants and the frost giants, even if they barge their way into Midgard."
"However," said Odin, aware that conditions would soon follow.
"I'll need 18 months, said the builder. 18 months from the day I begin.
That may not be impossible, said Odin the Alert One.
It is essential, said the Builder.
And your price? Asked Odin slowly.
I was coming to that, said the Builder. Freya as my wife.
The beautiful goddess sat bolt upright, and as she moved the necklace of the breezings, and her golden brooches and armbands, and the gold thread in her clothing glittered and flashed. None but Odin could look directly at her, Freya, fairest of goddesses, more beautiful even than Frigg, Annanna, and Ire, and Sif. And as she sat erect, the outraged gods all around her were shouting or waving their arms, deriding the Builder, dismissing the Builder.
That's impossible, shouted Odin. Let that be an end to it.
I'll also be wanting the sun and the moon, said the Builder. Freya, the sun, and the moon. That's my price.
Loki's voice rose out of the hubbub.
Every idea has its own merits. Don't dismiss it out of hand.
All the gods and goddesses turned to look at the sly one, the giant Farbauti's son, and wondered what was passing through the maze of his mind.
We must give the plan thought, said Loki reasonably. We owe our guest no less.
So the Builder was asked to leave Gladsheim while the gods and goddesses conferred. And when she saw that the gods were no longer ready to dismiss the idea out of hand, but wanted to discuss it in earnest, Freya began to weep tears of gold.
Don't be so hasty, Loki said. We could turn this plan to our own gain. Supposing we gave this man 6 months to build the wall.
He could never build it in that time, said Heimdall.
Never, echoed many of the gods.
Exactly, said Loki.
Odin smiled.
So what would we lose by suggesting it, said Loki. If the Builder won't agree, we lose nothing. If he does agree, he's doomed to lose.
Loki slapped his sides and rolled his eyes.
And we'll have half our wall built free and for nothing.
Although the gods and goddesses were a little uneasy about taking Loki's advice, they could see no way to fault the trickster's scheme. Indeed, several of them wished they had thought of it themselves.
6 months, said Odin when the Builder had come back into Gladsheim. If you build the wall within this time, you can have Freya as your wife, and take the sun and moon too. 6 months.
The Builder shook his head, but Odin continued.
Tomorrow is the first day of winter. You must agree that no one will come to help you, and if any part of the wall is still unfinished on the first day of summer, you forfeit your reward. Those are our terms, and there are none other.
Impossible terms, said the Builder. And you know it.
He paused and gazed at Freya.
But my longing, he said, my longing.
He gazed at Freya again.
Then at least allow me the help of my stallion, Svadilfari.
Those are our terms, said Odin.
And those are mine, said the Builder. Odin, you're too stubborn, protested Loki.
And there are none other, said Odin firmly.
What's wrong with allowing him the use of his horse? Shouted Loki. How could it possibly affect the outcome? If we refuse, there will be no bargain and we'll have no part of the wall at all.
In the end, Loki's argument prevailed. It was agreed that the Builder should begin work on the next morning and have the use of his horse. Odin swore oaths to this effect in front of many witnesses, and the Builder also asked for safe conduct for as long as he worked on the wall. He said he was anxious in case Thor, who was away in the east fighting trolls at that time, would return home and fail to see matters in the way the other gods had done. Long before Early Walker and All Swift set off on their journey across the sky, the Builder started work. By the light of the new moon, he had Svadilfari down over a sweeping grassy shoulder and past a copse to the place where the bones of the hill were sticking out, chipped and twisted. There were huge hunks and chunks and boulders of rock there, stuff that looked as though it would last as long as time itself. The Builder brought with him a loosely meshed net, which he harnessed to his stallion and spread out behind him. Then he began to heave and shove massive slabs onto the net. He gasped and grunted. Amongst the gods, only Thor could have matched his strength.
After some time, he had levered and piled up a great mound of rock behind Svadilfari. Then the builder gathered up the net ends in his thorny hands, as though he were folding a sheet, and bellowed. At once Svadilfari bowed his head. He dug his shoes into the earth and began to haul. Mustering his vast strength, he dragged the whole quaking mound up the slope, and as the day dawned, the builder and his stallion, guffing in the freezing air, brought their load up beside the old broken wall of Asgard. When the gods and goddesses stirred from their halls, they were astonished and disturbed to see how much rock Svadilfari had hauled up the hill. They watched the masons smash the boulders and shape them, and set them in place while Svadilfari rested in the shadow of the growing wall. And such was his strength, they began to think that the mason could only be some giant in disguise. But then the gods looked upon the great circuit of broken wall that remained. They reassured each other that they had, in any case, got the best of the bargain. Winter bared its teeth. Hrasvelg beat his wings, and outside Asgard the cold wind whirled. The land was drenched by rainstorms and pelted with hailstorms, then draped in snow. The giant mason and his horse gritted their teeth and worked at the wall. Night after night, Svadilfari plowed the long furrow past the copse to and from the quarry. Day after day, the mason went on building, and as the days grew longer, time for the mason, and for the gods, grew shorter. 3 days before the beginning of summer, the mason had almost completed the circuit of well-cut and well-laid stone, a sturdy wall high and strong enough to keep any unwelcome visitor at bay. Only the gateway still had to be built. The gods and goddesses were no more able to keep away from the wall than moths from a flame. They stared at it. For the 100th time, they talked of nothing but the bargain. Then Odin called a meeting in Gladsheim. The high hall was filled with anxious faces and fretful talk. Freya was unable to stem her tears. The floor around her was flooded with gold. Odin raised his spear and his voice over the assembly.
"We must find a way out of this contract," he shouted. "Who suggested we should strike this bargain? How did we come to risk such an outcome? Freya married to the brute of a giant. The sky raped of the sun and the moon so that we shall have to grope about, robbed of light and warmth."
Several gods, and then every god, looked at Loki, and Odin strode across the hall floor toward him. He took a firm grip on the trickster's shoulders.
"How was I to know?" protested Loki. "We all agreed."
Odin tightened his grip and Loki winced.
"We all agreed," yelled Loki.
"Who suggested the mason should be allowed to have the use of his horse?" Odin asked. "You got us into this trouble and you must get us out of it."
There was a shout of agreement from all the gods.
"Use the warp and weft of your mind, Loki. Weave some plan. Either the mason forfeits his wages or you forfeit your life."
Odin squeezed Loki's flesh and sinews until the Sly One, the shape-changer, dropped to one knee.
"We'll take it out of you, bit by bit."
Loki saw that Odin and the other gods were in deadly earnest.
"I swear," he said, "no matter what it costs me, I'll see to it that the builder loses the wager."
That evening, the mason led Svadilfari down towards the quarry with a certain spring in his step. It seemed to him, as to the gods and goddesses, that he would finish the wall within the agreed time and win rewards rich not only in themselves, but also in the sorrow that their loss would bring to the gods. He sang a kind of tune, and small birds took shelter in the gloomy copse and listened to his song. Not only the birds. A young mare pricked up her ears and listened intently. Then, when Svadilfari and the mason drew close enough, she sprang out of the thicket. She kicked her heels in the air, and in the moonlight her flanks shimmered. The mare pranced up to Svadilfari. She danced around him and whisked her tail, and Svadilfari began to strain at the long rein by which the mason was leading him. Then the mare whinnied invitingly and headed back towards the copse. Svadilfari started after her with such a thrust that he broke the rein. He galloped behind the mare into the copse, and the mason lumbered after Svadilfari, shouting and cursing. All night the two horses gambled. And all night the outraged mason tripped over roots and tree stumps in the half-light. He hurled abuses, he chased shadows, and the night had begun to grow green in the east before Svadilfari returned to him. So no stone was hauled from the quarry that night, and the mason had to make do with what little was left over from the day before. It was not nearly enough to build the first part of the gateway, and he soon knew that he would no longer be able to complete the task in time. Then, the anger churning inside the mason erupted. He burst out of his disguise and stood before the watching gods and goddesses, a towering brute of a rock giant in a towering rage. Now that the gods knew the builder was indeed a giant, they revoked their oaths about his safe conduct without a second thought and sent for Thor.
"A trick!" shouted the rock giant. "Tricked by a gang of gods and a brothel of goddesses!"
Those were the mason's last words. Then Thor paid him his wages, and they were not the sun and the moon. A single blow from the hammer Mjolnir shattered the giant's skull into 1,000 fragments and dispatched him to the endless dark of Niflheim. A number of months passed before Loki, the shape-changer, was seen in Asgard again, and when he returned, ambling over Bifrost and blowing a raspberry at Heimdall as he passed Himinbjorg, he had a colt in tow. This horse was rather unusual in that he had 8 legs. He was gray, and Loki called him Sleipnir. When Odin saw Sleipnir, he admired the colt greatly.
"Take him," said Loki. "I bore him, and he'll bear you. You'll find he can outpace golden and joyous, shining and swift, silver-maned and sinewy, gleaming and hollow-hoofed, gold mane and light feet, and outrun whatever horses there are in Jotunheim. No horse will ever be able to keep up with him."
Odin thanked Loki warmly and welcomed him back to Asgard.
"On this horse you can go wherever you want," said Loki. "He'll gallop over the sea and through the air. What other horse could bear its rider down the long road to the land of the dead and then bear him back to Asgard again?"
Odin thanked Loki a second time and looked at the Sly One very thoughtfully. The Lord of the Gallows. The axis of the world was Yggdrasil. That ash soared, and its branches fanned over gods and men and giants and dwarfs. It sheltered all creation. One root dug deep into Niflheim, and under that root of the spring, Vergelmir seethed and growled like water in a cauldron. Down there, the dragon Nidhogg ripped apart corpses. Between mouthfuls, he sent the squirrel, Ratatosk, whisking up the trunk from deepest earth to heaven. It carried insults to the eagle who sat on the topmost bough, with a hawk perched on its brow. And Nidhogg was not content with corpses. He and his vile accomplices gnawed at the root of Yggdrasil itself, trying to loosen what was firm and put an end to the eternal. Other creatures, too, attacked and preyed off the living tree. 4 stags nibbled at the new leaves, and goats tugged and tore off the tender shoots. Parts of the huge trunk were peeling, parts were soft and rotten. Yggdrasil whimpered, and Yggdrasil groaned. A second root curled into Asgard. Under that root flowed the well of Urd, the spring of destiny, where the gods gathered each day and held a court of justice. The 3 Norns lived nearby, fate and being and necessity. They shaped the life of each man from his first day to his last, and every day they sprinkled water on the branches of Yggdrasil and nourished the suffering tree. The 3rd root burrowed into that part of Jotunheim held by the frost giants. Under that root bubbled the spring guarded by wise Mimir, and the water in that well gave insight to those who tasted it. The god Heimdall left his shrieking horn there until the day when he would need it to summon every living creature to Ragnarok. And Odin had given up one eye for a single draught from it. He won immense knowledge there, and with it the thirst for yet greater wisdom. So the Terrible One approached Yggdrasil alone. Odin said, "I hung from that wind-swept tree, hung there for 9 long nights. I was pierced by a spear. I was an offering to Odin, myself to myself. No one has ever known
or will ever know the roots of that ancient tree. No one came to comfort me with bread. No one revived me with a drink from a horn. I peered at the worlds below. I seized the runes. Shrieking, I seized them. Then I fell back. From Balthor's famous son, Bestla's father, I learned 9 powerful songs. I was able to drain the precious mead from the cauldron Odrorir. Then I began to thrive. My wisdom grew. I prospered and was fruitful. One word gained me many words. One deed gained me many deeds. The charms I know are not known by the wives of kings, nor by any men. The first is called Help, because it can comfort grief and lessen pain and cure sickness. I know a second. Any man who hopes to become a healer needs to know it. I know a third. If I should sorely need help to hold back my enemy, I can blunt my opponent's blade and soften his staff so that he cannot wound me. I know a fourth. If anyone should bind me hand and foot, this charm is so great that the locks spring apart, releasing my limbs. I can walk free. I know a fifth. If I should see a well-aimed arrow speeding to its mark, I can catch it however fast it flies. I have only to fix it with my eye. I know a sixth. If anyone thinks to finish me by sending a sapling's roots engraved with runes, that hero, full of spleen, will only destroy himself. I know a seventh. If I should see the hall roof burst into flames over the heads of my chosen comrades, I can quench the blaze, however fierce it may be. I know the charm. I know an eighth. All men would be well advised to learn it. If hatred takes root in men's minds, I can uproot it. I know a ninth. If I should need to save my ship in a storm, I can calm the wind that whips off wave crests and put the sea to sleep. I know a tenth. If ever I see witches flying on rafters, I can sing so that they go into a whirl and cannot change back into their day shapes or find their way to their own front doors. I know an eleventh. If I have to lead loyal, long-loved friends into a fight, I can sing behind my shield, and they will go from strength to strength, unscathed to the battle, unscathed after battle, unscathed they return home. I know a twelfth. If I see a hanged man swinging from a tree with his heels above my head, I can cut and color the runes so that he will come down and talk to me. I know a thirteenth. If I sprinkle water over a child, he will never fall in the thick of battle, nor falter and sink in the sword play. I know a fourteenth. If I so desire, I can tell men the names of the gods and the elves one by one. Few fools can do this. I know a fifteenth. The dwarf Theodrorir sang it in front of Daling's doors. A charm of power for the gods, glory for the elves, wisdom for Odin. I know a sixteenth. If I long for love play, I can turn the mind and win the heart of a white-armed woman. I know a seventeenth. Such a charm that the young girl will be loath to forsake me. I know an eighteenth. I will never tell it to a girl or married woman unless I am lying in her arms, or she is my own sister. What you and you alone know is always the most potent. And that is the last of the charms. Those were the words of Odin, before there were men. These were his words after his death, when he rose again.